This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartmann here with you. On the line with us is Congressmember Karen Bass. She represents the 37th District of California and is the chair-elect, in other words, will be the chair in, as the new Congress is sworn in early January, of the Congressional Black Caucus for the 116th Congress. Her website, bass.house.gov. You can tweet her at Rep. Karen Bass. Representative Karen Bass, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us. So tell us about where the Congressional Black Caucus is at right now and where you see it going under your leadership as we go into this next congressional two-year cycle.
Well, absolutely. Well, we are going into the cycle not only with 55 members of the Congressional Black Caucus, but with Democrats being in the majority. And that means out of the 55 members, five will be chairs of full committees, and 28 members of the Black Caucus will be chairs of subcommittees. So that covers an array of areas of policy, from homeland security, financial services, education, science, etc. So I think that we're online to have a very big impact on Congress this year.
How do you see that playing out? I mean, we've seen an assault over the last decade or so. Well, really in an ongoing way, I suppose you could even go all the way back to 1990, an assault on civil rights legislation, an assault on voting rights legislation, an assault both by the Supreme Court and by Congress in many regards. Do you see Congress right now, particularly with the Republican-controlled Senate and a grifter in the White House, for lack of a better phrase, do you see your role as kind of holding back the dike, you know, holding back the dam, the preventing the flood of destructive legislation, or do you think that it's possible to actually advance a progressive caucus that is more inclusive, that brings, you know, that brings Americans together around issues or past issues of race, or however I should appropriately say that. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
I absolutely do. And you know what? I think it's all of the above, because we are absolutely going to have to be on the defense, but I also think on the offense. So, for example, voting rights. Because of the Supreme Court decision a few years ago, essentially gutting voting rights, the Supreme Court passed the ball back to Congress to put forward new legislation. And so that is going to be an item that is very high up on our agenda. And then we're going to have to play defense as well. You know, a lot of the cuts and rollbacks and civil rights legislation and regulations that this administration has done, and you can go down the line in terms of the cabinet secretaries and essentially the orders that this administration has given them to gut the very purpose of their agencies, whether we are talking about Health and Human Services, Department of Justice, Education, etc. So it's going to be defense and it's going to be offense. And having said that, I am hopeful that we will be able to get certain things done.
Yeah, we're also seeing this now with Mick Mulvaney running the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. I mean, which brings up the point that, you know, African Americans are not just concerned about issues of race. I mean, you know, we're all people here. We're, you know, works and, you know, workplace issues, banking issues, family issues, you know, issues that right across the spectrum. Again, we have this huge difference between a Republican Party that, for example, in Michigan passed in order, the good citizens of Michigan had a ballot initiative that they had all ready to go on the ballot that would raise the minimum wage and increase benefits. And the Republicans passed a law that said the exact same thing, so that the ballot initiative got bumped off the ballot. And then as soon as the election happened, in fact, I think it was yesterday, the House, the Republican House in Michigan, my home state, passed a law saying that we're gutting the law that we passed 2 months ago. And so it was like, I mean, it's like the Republicans are in this relentless, never-ending search for ways to take more money away from working people and give it to their billionaire patrons. What is the Congressional Black Caucus's position on these things, and how are you working with other caucuses, like the Congressional Progressive Caucus, for example, and other groups to bring about some sense of not just fairness, but a reasonable standard of living for working people in the United States?
Well, absolutely. I mean, a couple of other examples. Look at what happened in Wisconsin when they elected a Democratic governor. And so in the lame duck session before the new governor takes over, they decided they were going to reduce the power that the governor had. And so the interesting thing about the Republican Party now, and frankly, I believe that the Republican Party has been taken over by an extremist element, is one thing that is consistent in their policies is a rollback of democracy. So instead of expanding the voters, instead of making it easier for people to vote, they want to do the exact opposite. There's the race in North Carolina. The Republicans are always shouting about voter fraud. Well, talk about voter fraud. How about the guy that was going door to door collecting ballots and only turning in the ones that were that were in favor of him? So we have a congressional seat now that they might have to have an entirely new election because the process was so corrupted. Or in Georgia, where the Secretary of State, the guy who's counting the ballots, is also running for election. Some of the things that have happened this year regarding voter suppression and voter fraud that the Republicans have done really almost is what you hear about in other countries. And so I think educating people in general about the significant rollbacks and assault on democracy, hopefully the resistance movement that was launched the day after the inauguration, I think is absolutely delivered. I think it delivered the midterm election. But we have to keep this going. So we got one-third of the way there. And in 2020, hopefully we'll get the other two-thirds, which is the Senate and the White House. Because until we have all three, we won't be able to pass comprehensive legislation, and we also won't be able to stop the judges. I do believe we'll be able to get a lot done going one-third, but clearly we need to go the rest of the way in 2020.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in Congress passing legislation basically for display? Medicare for All, for example, there's no way the Senate would go along with that because it's controlled by Republicans. There's no way Trump would sign it. Well, actually, Trump might do anything. God only knows. But, there's no way Mitch McConnell's going to allow that to happen. So, I understand that there's like some discussion about, okay, do we pass the things that actually have a possibility of making it into law, even if they're kind of milquetoast, but they're important and necessary? Or do we go really big and show the American people this is the agenda that you'll have in 2020 if you put Democrats into office? Or, can we walk and chew gum? Can we do both?
Well, I definitely think we can walk and chew gum. And let me just give you an example. We need to repair the damage that has been done to the Affordable Care Act. So there are certain things that we need to do that I believe we should pass, and hopefully the Senate will be able to go along. Now, having said that, I believe that health care is a basic right. I think we should view health care just like you view K-12 education. You don't even think about that. Now, you can go to private school if you want, but you know that you're guaranteed an education in this country, and that's the way I think health care should be. But it's not going to be that way tomorrow. And for people who don't have insurance, I know they might like to see Medicare for All, but they need to see a doctor tomorrow. So I think that we can chew gum and walk at the same time. I'm sure we will do some legislation that might be more symbolic, might be more messaging, but I absolutely believe that the way we are going to approach legislating and governing is that we actually believe in government. When you have a party that really people ran for election to dismantle government, then it was very hard for them when they were in power. I think it will be easier for us when we're in power because Democrats, believe in government, believe in the institutions. People didn't run to be elected to destroy the very institution that they joined.
We're talking with Representative Karen Bass, the U.S. Congress member from California's 37th District, who was just elected the chair, will be the chair in the incoming Congress of the Congressional Black Caucus, bass.house.gov, and Rep. Karen Bass on Twitter. Tell me about how caucuses work in the House of Representatives. Is it possible to be a member of the Progressive Caucus and the Black Caucus? And if so, what kind of overlap do you have there? And are there other caucuses that we should know of that are doing good, progressive work?
Sure. I'm a member of both, for example. There's a lot of overlap between the Black Caucus and other caucuses. So, for example, a lot of members of the Black Caucus are members of the Progressive Caucus. A lot of members are members of the New Democrat new Democratic caucus, which focuses more on business and trade. And so you find members that we have a member of the Black caucus that's a blue dog, which is the conservative caucus.
Wow.
So you have the diversity within the Black caucus just like you do any other caucus.
That is great. It's fascinating stuff, and I wish you the very best of luck. You've got a big job ahead of you in the next 2 years, and I wish you all the very best. Congressmember Karen Bass, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thanks for having me on.
It has been great getting to know you and great talking with you. Thank you so
much.
Appreciate that. Yeah, okay. Me too. We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program, 16 minutes past the hour, the place where we are helping you win the water cooler wars.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. And welcome back, Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. It's a pleasure and an honor to listen to Professor Wolf and also Bob Ney. He's brilliant. I enjoy them so much.
Me too.
Also, I think I may have won the free book, but I just happened to think about it.
Oh, yeah? Okay, you've got a piece of legislation that was proposed and voted into office with a majority of Republicans and that benefits average working people.
Well, I don't know if it was by the majority of Republicans. That really wasn't why I called, but George H.W., he did the Americans for Disability Act. It still needs to go farther.
That was the Democrats who pushed that forward. He just happened to be president.
Okay.
Democrats controlled the House of Representatives at that time.
Thanks for the clarification and
sure.
Straight whole country out there, too, on that. I just wanted to say that basically, between Trump, Walker in Wisconsin, these shenanigans in Michigan, North Carolina, and Jim Snowball Imhoff, we all remember him. He's the goofball who brought that snowball into Congress a year or so back to state that there's
right.
No global warming.
He's still denying global warming. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's still taking money from the fossil fuel industry.
Oh, it's shameful. And all it does is just emphasize to the nation that the thug and rethuglican is still there and it's going strong. And it just outlies the only care about for the wealthy, and it's just nothing for the common man. But lastly, I just wanted to say is we really do have to hold Saudi Arabia accountable for all these atrocities, and especially for Khashoggi as well. And we've got so much corruption going on there. And it's funny how he wants to cozy up to North Korea, and also Saudi Arabia.
He being Trump.
Yes, sorry. And it's just mind-boggling. But I know you want to move on, Tom, but thank you.
Thank you, Steve. It's good talking with you. I appreciate the call. And spot on. Very, very well said. Holly in Marshall, Missouri. Hey, Holly, what's up?
Well, I'm not sure you can help, but here in rural Missouri, in our small county, we have some great candidates, but they have no money. And what happens is every time we want to run someone for office, it winds up being someone who has a lot of money. And are there methods of raising money for really terrific low, people who don't have money?
Well, this is, Holly, you've put your finger on probably the biggest problem or one of the biggest problems in our electoral system right now, which is that it's very hard to be able to just leave a job and run for office. And it's very hard for low-income people to run for office. The solution is public financing of campaigns. Very, very straightforward process where if you get a certain level of support, when we did it here in Portland years ago, it was if you can get 1,000 people to sign a petition and give you $5, then the state will give you $100,000 to run your campaign, or the city would, actually. Go ahead.
Even in a red state?
Well, this was just something that the city of Portland did. But what we need to do is have a system like this at the federal level. And it's Bernie Sanders has been pushing for this for decades, along with a lot of other good progressives. And it's called, campaign finance reform, essentially, in part. And we really need to do it. Holly, you've really nailed one of the most important issues out there. And there's a lot of different ways to do it, but that's the easiest. Holly, I got to run, but thank you for the call. We'll be right back. It's 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Kevin in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I was thinking about reframing the North Carolina thing as to what is actually inside of our sphere of influence, and we can change our registration.
Which North Carolina thing are you talking about?
The North Carolina law saying that the control of the elections will be to the minority or majority party, and how
depending on odd and even years. In other words, basically, Republicans run the elections on even years, which is when elections happen. There are some elections on odd years, but they're few and far between. There's no federal elections, and that the Republicans would run the elections on the years that Congress is elected and on the years that the president is elected, all the years that end with odd numbers. This is not law yet, by the way. It was just proposed yesterday in the House of Representatives in North Carolina. But the Republicans are, you know, gung-ho for this. Back to you, Kevin.
We could play this to our own advantage by figuring out what rules and when to change registration. I saw Trevor Noah suggest this on his show the other day, and I looked up my old email actually to Reverend Barber, who was probably ignored, saying, have everybody in North Carolina change their registration, then they won't be able to gerrymander, and how will they figure out how to give the bad voting machines and where to put them? I think they still will.
You know, if North Carolina is an open primary state, then there might be some strategic sense to having everybody register as a Republican. On the other hand, if it's a closed primary state, you have to be registered as a Democrat to vote in the Democratic primary. I don't know which it is, frankly.
It is probably going to be complicated, but there are things that are within our sphere of control that we could use to our own advantage. And people keep saying that we should be as dogged and determined as the Republicans are in our efforts to...
Yeah. I absolutely agree, Kevin. The one thing we don't want to do is be as unethical and disgusting as they are, but I don't think anybody's proposing that. I don't think you are either. It's worthy of discussion. Kevin, thank you very much. Jim in Valley Center, California. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yes, the donation by the Saudis at the inauguration of Trump to get 500 rooms at the Trump Hotel to bring in American veterans to lobby against the victims of 9/11. That I heard that this morning on Morning Joe,
right.
And that is a blockbuster story if true.
Yeah, no, it is true. And the veterans, in fact, one of the veterans this is incredible. The average nightly rate at the hotel, by the way, was $768. This is from David Ferenthal in the Washington Post today. Some of the veterans who stayed at Trump's hotel say they were kept in the dark about the Saudis' role in the trips. Now they wonder if they were used twice over, not just to deliver someone else's message to Congress, but also to deliver business to the Trump organization. And then this is a quote from Henry Garcia, a Navy veteran from San Antonio, who went on three trips. He says, it made all the sense in the world when we found out the Saudis had paid for it. He had believed the trips were organized by other veterans, but that puzzled him because this group spent money like no veterans group he'd ever worked with. Private hotel rooms, open bars, free dinners. Then he said one of the organizers who'd been drinking minibar champagne mentioned a Saudi prince. And he said, oh, I get it now. We were just used to give Trump money. So that's what's going on here.
Outrageous.
Yeah, it really is. And what's also outrageous in sort of a sick way is, I mean, this was $250,000, just this one event. If you look at the Chicago hotel, the New York hotel, it looks like the Saudis have transferred, you know, probably in the neighborhood of $1 million to Trump in the first, you know, in the first few months of his presidency, which got him over to Saudi Arabia as his first overseas trip. And now Jared Kushner's in tight with the Saudis and the Emiratis so that they can bail out his building and all this kind of stuff. What's so outrageous in this sick sort of way is how low his price is, how easily bribed he was.
And how he can also use that to give cover for the assassination of a Washington Post journalist who has two American people. You know, we forget that.
No, you're absolutely right, it's astonishing, and I think it's a criminal. I do believe that this is bribery. Jim, I got to run, but thank you for your call. Yeah, this is a clear violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, in addition to being bribery. We're going to be back. We're going to check in with Stephen Cohen, talk about Russia in a bit. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
I think the next half hour is going to be fascinating. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us, our old buddy Stephen Cohen, Professor Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU and Princeton, the author of several books, including Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, and his latest book just came out, War with Russia, From Putin and Ukraine to Trump and Russiagate. The website, thenation.com. And Professor Cohen, welcome back to the program. It's been a while.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a long time.
Yeah. So what is your sense of, and in fact, you just came back from Russia, I believe.
Got back last Sunday, correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is your sense of the current nature of the United States' relationship to Russia? And having been in Russia for the last couple of weeks, what's your sense of their sense of it?
The relationship, and this I argue in this new book, War with Russia, but it has a question mark after it. It's not a declaration. But it's meant to convey my sense that the relationship with Russia today is as bad and as dangerous as it's ever been. And I'm mindful that most people think the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 was the worst. But in some ways, this is even more dangerous, or getting there. This is due to a lot of factors, including this thing we call Russiagate. The Russians I dealt with, talked with when I was there for a week, are puzzled about the turmoil involving Russia in the United States, particularly the allegations against Trump and his attempts to have negotiations with Putin in summit or other meetings. Puzzled and getting increasingly despairing. More and more, there's a sense at the very top in Russia, I mean at the Kremlin level, and this is not good, that dealing with the Americans has become impossible. And this, too, is unprecedented, and this, too, is a factor in why the new situation is exceedingly dangerous.
If the press reports are correct, and I have no reason to believe that they're not, after it came out that Donald Trump had been attempting, the Michael Cohen testimony, that Trump had been attempting to negotiate a Trump Tower with the Putin administration right up to June or July of 2016, you know, during the campaign. And then Peskov came out and said, yeah, that's actually true. Here's the last communication that we had with Trump. That sounds to me like they've just decided to cut him loose. What do you think about that? What does that mean?
You mean that Peskov released this correspondence?
Right, right. And basically confirmed, at least this is what I read in the paper. I mean, I haven't seen a copy of the correspondence. But, confirmed that, yes, Donald Trump was negotiating. And this was, I'm assuming this is not at all illegal in Russia. And it may not be illegal here. It may just be highly, politically inappropriate. But that, he had been negotiating for a Trump Tower in Moscow right up through the middle of the, at the same time he was leading rallies, lock her up, while he was the official nominee of the Republican Party. That if Russia had been holding that back, they were in a way kind of protecting Trump, probably in the hopes of a better relationship. But now they've put that information out. That signals to me, and I'm not the wise observer of this stuff that you are. I mean, you're an expert. But that seems to me that Putin, or the Putin administration anyway, is saying, okay, screw it. It's like, we're not going to protect this guy anymore. We're not going to do anything with this guy anymore. We're just going to do our own business.
So we need a little context, because the allegations and the suppositions, and I must say the mainstream media account in this country of what we call Russiagate, that is, allegations that Trump was somehow compromised by the Kremlin or in cahoots with the Kremlin, totally lacks context. So let's take this episode, because it's important. About 150 large American corporations have been doing business in Russia since the end of the Soviet Union and continue to do so. And this ranges from Kentucky Fried Chicken, Wendy's, McDonald's, to Ford and Pfizer, and all the big companies have found markets there. This is also true of major international hotel chains like the Trump Company. Trump began many years ago trying to build in Russia. What's significant to me, Tom, if you and I were to go to Moscow tomorrow and walk around the city, we would see almost every international hotel brand, Marriott, Sheraton, Ritz-Carlton, all over Moscow.
I've stayed at the Ritz-Carlton in Moscow.
Well, then you know, right? What's missing, strikingly, is a Trump Tower and a Trump Hotel. That is, after all these years of trying, long before he became a presidential candidate, he was almost alone among the international hotelers who were trying to build in Moscow and was unable to do so. So if he had any swat with the Kremlin, it didn't manifest itself in what he wanted there. Now, this continued with people who, I don't want to be cruel, but operated in sleazy ways on his behalf, including Michael Cohen.
And Felix Sater and these guys.
Yeah, these guys, who operated in their own way, who were clumsy in Moscow. I mean, when they wrote to the Kremlin, to the presidential office, they didn't even have an email address. They sent to a general box. And eventually it came to Peskov, who's I know fairly well, who's, you know, Putin's personal spokesman. So what happened then later? These people kept trying, even while Trump had become a candidate, and even while it appeared, I think the date you mentioned was June or July 2016,
right.
It appeared he would be the nominee. So it has now become, what they did up to then was completely kosher, and exactly what scores of American and other international corporations have done. That you need permits in Moscow. You deal with the mayor of Moscow for that. But really big permits, like changing the skyline of Moscow or doing subsoil contracting like mining for gold and oil, has to go through the Kremlin. So they were doing what other corporations did. What made it a problem at this moment was they kept doing it when Trump was virtually going to be the nominee. Did he know about it? I don't know. But it was on automatic. They were peppering people in the Kremlin with requests to help them with permits and the rest, right up until they killed the project. So I don't see anything, criminal or suspicious in this, just kind of klutzy behavior on the part of people who had been representing him in Moscow for maybe 4 or 5 years and kept doing so. They didn't stop when they should have stopped.
Well, where this may violate, if not American traditions, certainly American campaign finance law, is that if, and this is the whole hit on Trump about Kerry McDougal and Stormy Daniels, is that if he is essentially covering something up, and particularly if he's employing other people to cover something up that would hurt him in a political campaign, that's the equivalent of a campaign contribution, that process. And so if it had been broadly known in the United States through the first 6 months of 2016, or for that matter, for the last 6 months of 2015, when he was, you know, an official candidate for the Republican nomination, that he was at the same time negotiating with what is, you know, broadly across America considered to be, if not a hostile power, at least not a close ally of the United States. And we can have another conversation about whether that, you know, how that should change. But you know, if that reality or if that perception was widely shared, if Hillary Clinton could have gone after him, for example, or for that matter, Ted Cruz could have gone after Trump for saying, well, you know, you realize this guy's in the middle of negotiating with Russia to build a hotel there. I mean, you know, at the same time that a large part of what Trump was saying was we've got to have better relations with Moscow. They got the Republican National Committee to change their position on Russian sanctions and on Ukraine, as I recall. That seems pretty bad, Steve.
It doesn't to me, Tom. I mean, you have bought into this whole Russiagate narrative.
Apparently.
Wait a minute. I do not. And if people want to hear an alternative view or read it, my book is not long. It deals with these issues. It's based on what I've known and learned over the years. This book, War with Russia?
Right.
So I've laid it out all there. Most of this seems like malarkey to me and one-eyed. So let me give you an example. I've already mentioned that if you take the attitude that Trump was doing some something wrong with trying to invest in a big way in Russia, quote, as you put it, a country that is hostile to us or not an ally, that means you can't go to McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Wendy's, you can't buy a Ford automobile. I've told you, there are
none of them are running for president.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, this began with Trump long before he became a candidate.
Sure.
I mean, what happened in 2016, I agree, needs to be sorted out. But, you know, corporate investments have take on a life of their own. Corporations spend millions of dollars trying to get in a position to make millions of dollars. You would exist. You would agree with that.
Sure.
And Russia became an enormous consumer and extractive and manufacturing market. I think there's something like 9,000 German firms doing business in Russia and scores of big American brand names. So, including, household brands, you know, the detergents we use, Procter & Gamble, for example, is all over Russia.
No, but again, the president of P&G is not running for president of the United States.
Right. Things changed in 2016. I agree. So let's look at what happened in 2016. It was lousy on the part of both campaigns. We can't just focus on Trump if we want to understand what was going on. So a lot is being made of this meeting in Trump Tower. I think it was in June 2016.
Right.
Trump's son, Don Jr., and a group of his associates met with this lawyer from Russia, correct?
Yeah, yeah, Veselnitskaya.
And they were allegedly, she was peddling something they didn't understand, orphans. They didn't have any idea of what she was talking about. But this was a big issue because the Russians had banned American adoptions into orphans, and there are about 20 American families.
And this was in response to the Magnitsky Act.
Exactly right. So they didn't know about that. They were untutored, uninformed, unwise, and they never should have seen a Russian if they didn't know what was on the agenda, orphans. Mm. And when they kept saying orphans, orphans, the media said they're lying, they weren't. That's what she wanted to talk about. She wanted to give orphans for some company she was representing. And what were the Russians promising? It said dirt on Hillary Clinton, correct?
Yeah, that's what the email said.
All right. Now, at that exact same moment, what was the Hillary Clinton campaign doing? They were paying Christopher Steele through an intermediary to get dirt on Trump from whom? From Russians. Now, the difference is here, Trump didn't pay a dime. He didn't get any information. Clinton paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to this guy, Christopher Steele, and he produced this dossier. So which is worse? Well, as the Russians would say, both are worst. Neither should have been doing this.
Well, but wait a minute, Stephen. We're excising something from this conversation, which is that the goal of Hillary's campaign was not to change U.S. foreign policy relative to Russia. To the extent that it was right out in the open. You know, she was fairly openly hostile to Russia. The goal of Veselnitskaya in her meeting with Don Jr. and Jared Kushner and company was to get the U.S. to drop their sanctions.
No,
and in exchange for that,
no,
they would drop the ban on Russian adoptions.
No, that's not correct. First of all, she didn't represent anybody, certainly not the Kremlin. She was a regional lawyer who had represented Russian corporations abroad, and a corporation hired her to try to get the State Department to drop a sanction against that specific corporation. It was a financial matter that was going to end up in New York courts. She didn't come to say, we want the American government to change its sanctions against Russia. It was about this specific company. Now, it is true, as I think you may have suggested before, that at the Republican convention, correct, a plank in the Republican platform regarding Ukraine was changed.
Yeah.
But
Stephen, we're going to hit a hard break in 10 seconds, just FYI.
But it was changed to conform with Obama's policy, which was not to ship weapons to Ukraine. So, I mean, you can't fault the Trump people for that.
That's interesting. I'd have to know a little more about
fact,
that.
Tom. I mean, it's just not.
Yeah. Can you stick around, Stephen?
Sure.
Okay. Professor Stephen Cohen is with us. He is the Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at New York University and Princeton, the author of several books, including Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, and his latest, War with Russia? From Putin and Ukraine to Trump and Russiagate. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of Stephen Cohen. The Chronicle Review calls him the most controversial Russia expert in America. Stick around. And welcome back. Professor Cohen, you were saying.
So you and I are going to have an argument here, but a friendly one, because we've known each other for years.
Yeah.
Look, one of the theses of my new book, and it's for general readers, not for scholars, it's got, again, this question mark, Russia, war with Russia, question mark. One of the theses is that the relationship with Russia is more dangerous than it's ever been, ever, Tom. Now, you could argue with that. I mean, that's a kind of historical quibble, maybe, but it's exceedingly dangerous.
I will always take your word on issues like
that. And it's exceedingly dangerous because the new Cold War is right on Russia's borders. We've seen in the last week or two, I was in Moscow when this happened, this conflict between Russian maritime ships and Ukrainian maritime ships in the Black Sea, right on Russia's borders. And now there's a story out late last night, I haven't confirmed it, that the United States has sent a battleship to the Black Sea. Really a bad idea.
Yeah.
But you can see that we're edging toward Cuban Missile Crisis types of situation.
Well, also Ukraine this morning, it was, I believe, in the Washington Post, that Ukraine has deployed missiles to the border?
Well, I don't even want to talk about
missiles.
What's going
I'm sorry, fighter jets.
But this is the tail wagging the dog, and that's why this new Cold War is really.
You mean Ukraine is the tail wagging the dog?
Yeah, of course. I mean, this provocation in the Sea of Azov, where the Russians have built the bridge, was clearly done by Ukraine for reasons that have to do with Ukrainian politics, not with international
security. Now, this just to be very clear about this, Poroshenko is his name, right? The guy who...
Yeah. The president of Ukraine is up for re-election in March.
That's right.
He's got about 12% in the polls. He appears to have no chance. It appears that what he wanted to do was create an international military incident, claim Russia was going to invade, and declare martial law, which he has done in 9 regions in Ukraine. And there's been a struggle in the Ukrainian parliament by his opponents, would-be opponents, in the Ukrainian presidential election in March, that he did this to abet his chances in the election. So he had to back off. This is driven by internal Ukrainian politics, but it's dragging us ever closer to a military conflict with Russia. This is the danger. So what happens now? And here's where, excuse me, Tom, here's where you and I come, if not the loggerheads, to a some kind of impasse. Several years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, you and I would be talking about something else today. We'd be talking about the danger of a new nuclear arms race. The
sure.
evidence is everywhere. We'd be saying, oh, my God, what's going on with American and Russian airplanes flying in the same space as Syria? What's going on? We'd be asking if it's a good idea if NATO's undertaking a massive buildup in the Baltic region, also on Russia's border. And we'd be saying to ourselves, is this wise policy? Aren't we getting very, very close to more than Cold War, hot war with Russia?
Certainly.
But instead, we're talking about Donald Trump and his hotels, his desire
right.
to buy hotel. That is why I take the position, you won't like this, but that the Russiagate allegations and the American media's obsession with it, and particularly the Democratic Party's obsession with it, has itself become a grave national security threat to America. And here's why, very simply. You remember, was it July, that Trump went to Helsinki, Finland to have a summit with Putin.
Yeah. Stephen, Professor, we're hitting a break here. Let's recap this.
He was accused of treason.
Yeah, if you can hold on just a second. I'm sorry, I don't control these breaks. We will be back in just a moment, Professor Cohen, and we'll reboot this conversation and you can make your point again, please. We're talking with Professor Stephen Cohen. We'll be right back. It's 53 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Professor Stephen Cohen is on the line with us. His new book, War with Russia, from Putin and Ukraine to Trump and Russiagate. The book just came out. And Professor Cohen, we were just talking about how Ukraine in some ways has become the tail that's wagging the dog. Poroshenko is running for re-election in March. He's got a 12% approval rating. Questions about whether he's provoking conflict just for his own internal political positions and things like this. And then you brought it back to the summer of 2016. I'm not sure exactly where you were going with that.
Well, we came back to the summer of 2016 because much of the investigation of Trump and Russia has focused on that meeting in Trump Tower and the search for dirt on Hillary. And I just made the point that Hillary was paying to get dirt on Trump also from Russians. Though personally, I don't think that Christopher Steele's dossier was actually based on any Russian reports. I don't think Steele was honest about where he got that information. But let me ask you a question. And you think about this, because it's become a big question when the Democrats occupy their new majority in the House. As I see it, we're at an existential moment in our relationship with Russia. Super dangerous. That's the thesis of the book, War with Russia, with a question mark, because nothing's predetermined or inevitable. As this obsession with these Russiagate allegations go on, and in the book, I go through the main allegations and say I can find no evidence whatsoever for them.
Right.
Most of this is felonious jaywalking, grifters, the kinds of people who have been doing these operations in other countries like Manafort for decades, Democrats and Republicans, not being open and honest about their financial transactions, but with nothing much political involved. That being said, I think we now face, and particularly Democrats, but not only in this country, a central question. Do we want most to impeach Trump, or do we want most to avoid war with Russia?
I would vote for the latter in every case. We have about 30 seconds.
You and I would always do so.
Yeah.
But I get the impression, listening to a number of these Democrats, like Adam Schiff and Swalwell and the others, that they haven't thought about this question.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it all needs to be put into a larger context. I agree with that. Professor Cohen, I'm sorry we're out of time, but it's always great talking with you.
No, it is. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, his new book, War with Russia, From Trump and Ukraine to Trump and Russiagate. It's a fascinating read, and I commend it to you. We will we'll be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us today. It's been a fascinating day, a lot going on in the world. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. It requires all of us. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.